The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Monitoring groups say they're the telltale signs of a chemical attack. Fainting, choking, and foaming at the mouth after what's believed to be a gas attack by Syrian government jets on a town just south of Idlib. According to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, at least 58 people were killed, among them 11 children under the age of 8. The head of Idlib's health authority has said there are 300 more who are wounded, claiming warplanes dropped either sarin or chlorine. A source in the Syrian military has strongly denied the allegations, insisting the Syrian army has never used such weapons and dismissing the actions as rebel propaganda. The footage was circulated on social media. In it are what appear to be members of the humanitarian group known as the White Helmets. They are hosing down children with water and performing CPR. A Reuters photographer witnessed the aftermath. His images are hard to dispute. The dead wrapped in blankets, survivors gasping for air. Monitoring groups claim warplanes struck again where the injured were being treated. It's not the first time the Syrian government's been accused of using chemical weapons. Western states believe it was behind the sarin attack in 2013, which killed hundreds. A report by the UN says it's used chemical weapons at least three times since. These latest accusations prompting France to call for an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council.
Hello and welcome to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Stephen Flurry. And that was a sobering introduction to, what really is a sobering subject about that shocking, what looks like sarin gas attack in Syria early this week. The latest reports, I think that report was from yesterday, but the latest, or even the day before, the latest put the number of dead at around 70 or 80, including over 20 children. The Reuters video that went with that report that we just heard, it showed aid workers desperately spraying down the limp bodies of children that were barely older than babies, you know, just little toddlers, attacked by the Syrian government using this brutal chemical weapon, this nerve toxin. Well, how did we get here, where a dictator uses nerve gas against his own people, against the children of his nation? Well, let me just read some of the headlines about this attack from across the news media. So Canada's National Post: Syria's children die choking. The West tut-tuts briefly and moves on. This is now normal. A somewhat lengthy headline, but that was their headline. The Chicago Tribune: to be a child in Syria, gas attacks, and a world that tolerates them. The Guardian: their headline was simply, Assad knows he acts with impunity. That was the title of their editorial. The Independent: the West has proved it cannot hold Russia to account in Syria. How many more have to die before it happens? So this is the message so many are taking from that massacre. America is impotent. The rest of the world stands by and does nothing while children die. Now remember, this is a problem. This is something that former President Barack Obama said he had solved. Here is actually what he said about Syria's chemical weapons just last summer.
I know, for example, that my decision not to conduct strikes against Syria after it used chemical weapons was controversial among some in Washington. But because we seized a diplomatic option backed by our threat of force, nations came together and we accomplished far more than military strikes ever could have. All of Syria's declared chemical weapons were successfully removed.
So that was it. Syria's chemical weapons successfully gone. Problem solved. That's what he thought, or at least said, just a few months ago. And now here we are. Assad is using chemical weapons yet again. And as you saw from those headlines, the rest of the world sees it and says, well, look how weak America is. Assad gasses his own civilians. He gasses children. America said that, well, this is a red line. We're going to stop that. And America does nothing. Remember, just mentioning that red line, here is what Mr. Obama said about Syria and the chemical weapons, famously, back in the summer of 2012.
I have, at this point, not ordered military engagement in the situation, but the point that you made about chemical and biological weapons is critical. That's an issue that doesn't just concern Syria. It concerns our close allies in the region, including Israel. It concerns us. We cannot have a situation where chemical or biological weapons are falling into the hands of the wrong people. We have been very clear to the Assad regime, but also to other players on the ground, that a red line for us is we start seeing a whole bunch of chemical weapons moving around or being utilized. That would change my calculus. That would change my equation.
So a red line for us is if chemical weapons are used, and then that, you know, that infamously set the red line, and as I think everyone's familiar with, Assad then went on and used chemical weapons. He crossed that red line, and, well, since then he has repeatedly gotten away with doing that. And to be clear, in this attack, we can be pretty sure that this was a nerve gas that was used, something like sarin that was used since 2012, and then since the subsequent deal with Vladimir Putin that we'll talk about in a minute. But since that deal to get rid of chemical weapons, Syria has generally used chlorine gas in its chemical attacks. And this is one of the oldest and most common chemical weapons. But under some circumstances, it's not quite classified as a chemical weapon, because chlorine has lots of other uses. You can put it in a swimming pool, for example. And so Assad and some of his backers have kind of tried to claim innocence on a technicality. But this looks like a full-on sarin gas attack. ABC News, they had a report this morning titled "Mounting Confidence Nerve Gas Was Used in Syria Attack." And they write, "Early U.S. assessments showed the use of chlorine gas and traces of the nerve agent sarin in the attack Tuesday that terrorized the Syrian town." And that's that town in the province in Syria, according to two U.S. officials who weren't authorized to speak publicly on the matter and demanded anonymity. Israeli military intelligence officials also believe Syrian government forces were behind the attack, Israeli defense officials told the Associated Press. Israel believes Assad has tons of chemical weapons still in his arsenal, despite a concerted operation 3 years ago by the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons to rid the government of its stockpile, said officials. So that effort to get rid of Syria's chemical weapons, it failed utterly. Israel believes that he still has tons of chemical weapons at his disposal, and we saw him on Tuesday use them. And then again, it says that those officials, they spoke on the condition of anonymity because they weren't authorized to talk to the media. This article also states that victims of the attack showed signs of nerve gas exposure, the World Health Organization and Doctors Without Borders said. So pretty impartial bodies there, lots of evidence stacking up, including suffocating, foaming at the mouth, convulsions, constricted pupils, and involuntary defecation. Paramedics were using fire hoses to wash down the chemicals from the bodies of the victims. Medical teams also reported smelling bleach on survivors of the attack, which suggests chlorine gas was also used, Doctors Without Borders said. And then this article also, it says, the magnitude of the attack was reflected in the images of the dead. Children piled in heaps for burial, a father carrying his lifeless young twins. The visuals from the scene were reminiscent of a 2013 nerve gas attack on the suburbs of Damascus that left hundreds dead and prompted an agreement brokered by the US and Russia to disarm Assad's chemical stockpiles. Well, look how that agreement worked out. Western nations blamed government forces for that attack, where effects were concentrated on opposition-held areas. And here's what Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry wrote back around 2012, 2013. I didn't note down the exact date on this article. But around that same time where's that deal brokered between Vladimir Putin and Mr. Obama to get rid of those chemical weapons. And he wrote, the war in Syria has been grinding on for over 2.5 years. More than 120,000 Syrians have been killed. This past summer, intelligence sources reported that Bashar Assad used chemical weapons on his own people. Finally, President Obama decided it was time to act, and he threatened to attack. Then something astonishing happened. The president had second thoughts and pulled back. And Russia's president, Vladimir Putin, stepped in and presented himself as the great peacemaker of our time. And then Mr. Flory just talks about how preposterous it is for Vladimir Putin to put himself forward as this great peacemaker. This man has done more to keep Bashar Assad in power in Syria than any other leader in the world. Russian weapons have probably been the main factor in preserving Assad's rule. Putin's backing of the Syrian regime is a major reason Assad has been so willing to slaughter his opponents by the tens of thousands. In addition, Putin wants to restrict America's power in the Middle East and everywhere else, and to strengthen his own. When it appeared America might attack Syria, Vladimir Putin put the brakes on by offering up a sham proposal to secure Syria's chemical weapons. He even wrote an article in that once great New York Times, shamefully publishing it in its op-ed pages, that was full of smooth-sounding hokum. And again, that's Mr. Flory's words, not mine. Like it or not, we must uphold international law. This is him paraphrasing Vladimir Putin. We must stop resorting to force. We need civilized diplomatic and political settlement, and so on. And Mr. Flory continues, what a farce! This is the man who invaded Georgia just 5 years ago without UN permission. The man who has ordered the elimination of tens of thousands of Chechens. The man who has openly supported Iran despite its sponsoring terrorism. He used to be an officer in the Soviet secret police. He is a great admirer of Stalin, who killed more of his own people than Adolf Hitler did. But what did President Obama do? He accepted Putin's offer. He played along, pretending like this was the peaceful, negotiated solution that he wanted. He even took credit for it, saying it was America's pressure that convinced Assad to give in. Now Putin is conducting the peace process of all things. The Obama administration is trusting this man to put Assad's weapons of mass destruction under international control and to guarantee Assad can no longer terrorize his people. Well, how did that trust turn out? How did trusting Putin to make sure that Assad cannot terrorize his own people turn out? Well, we can answer that quite clearly this week. Going back to this article from Mr. Flory, he said Charles Krauthammer called this the worst failure ever in US foreign policy. Now, he may well have seen that failure superseded by other failures since then, but going back to this commentary magazine labeled President Obama's flip-flopping on Syria a debacle and said it showed staggering incompetence by the White House. The whole spectacle was an embarrassment for the United States on a massive failure. But few of our people see the deadly consequences. Well, we certainly saw the deadly consequences this week. Going back to this article, while all the phoniness was going on, what was Assad doing? The Wall Street Journal reported on September 2nd that a secretive Syrian military unit at the center of the Assad regime's chemical weapons program has been moving stocks of poison gases and munitions to as many as 50 sites. 50 sites, and we have that confirmation this week. They used the poison gas, and you've got Israeli defense officials saying, well, yep, we think they've still got tons of the stuff left. Back to this article. Naturally, with all the talk and warnings to Syria that inspections were coming, the Assad regime just moved the weapons so nobody can find them. Maybe the United Nations and the US knew where those chemicals were, but they probably don't anymore. Then the day after the journal ran its front page article about the Syrians shielding their weapons arsenal, Secretary of State John Kerry made the deal with Russia to have Vladimir Putin oversee confiscating Syria's weapons of mass destruction. This passes for a solution in this mad, mad world, Mr. Flory writes. Even a child can see the folly. But growing men are making these decisions. How can we be so naive? And if there are any questions about how foolish that was, how naive that policy was, how crazy of a solution to Syria's chemical weapons that was. Well, it's indisputable this week. There's zero arguing with it now. Assad used those chemical weapons once again. And there are all those pictures of those young children. They look like they were maybe 2 years old, some of them. Just lifeless. I don't know whether the ones that were shown in that video, whether they could have recovered. It certainly didn't look like it, though. Just these limp bodies of children, piles of bodies of these young children. Deadly consequences, indeed. You can go to just about any newspaper now and you can, you know, you can see them saying, well, look, Assad, like we said, Assad kills his own people while the rest of the world does nothing. Any newspaper, even things like The Guardian or The Independent that are usually thoroughly wrong, they see how ineffectual America is with this situation. And Mr. Flurry concludes that section that we just read by writing, you can be sure that Iran was watching this whole process very closely. And he's right. Think about this. You know, we can look at the Middle East. We can see so many areas where Mr. Obama's foreign policy and the foreign policy that previous administration failed utterly. We saw it in Syria this week. While also over the last week or so, we saw former Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. He's released from jail. And there have been so many articles talking about how Mr. Obama's reaction to the protests in Egypt and pushing Hosni Mubarak out of office, how that was an absolute disaster. And it's not just people like Melanie Phillips say, or Carolyn Glick, or some of those prospective commentators saying this anymore. Even Salon had an article this week titled, Egypt Goes From Bad to Worse. Under President Sisi, the nation longs for the good old days of Mubarak. You know, usually if I want to find some truly terrible article full of logical flaws and just far-left assumptions, you know, Salon's my go-to source for that. It's the best website in the internet for finding absolutely disastrous, flawed left-wing articles. And even they can see now that ousting Mubarak was a terrible, terrible failure. But the same people behind that failure in Syria, behind that failure in Egypt, well, they were behind the Iran deal. They were behind this deal that they said would stop Iran getting nuclear weapons. Well, how did their peace deal getting rid of chemical weapons in Syria go? How effective then do you think that the same team negotiating with the same types of people, well, how effective do you think they're going to be now, or they've been, with doing what they claimed in stopping Iran getting rid of its nuclear program? We just heard from that clip over the summer, Mr. Obama saying, well, that's it. We've got rid of all of Assad's declared stockpile of weapons. He doesn't have chemical weapons anymore. Well, how reliable are his statements then when he said, well, we've signed this deal that's going to stop Iran from getting a nuclear bomb? That Syria deal, we've seen that just proven thoroughly ineffective so quickly. But back to Syria, I'll just read to you some of the points that people have been making about this attack. I'll quote a bit from that National Post article that I mentioned at the start. That one was titled, Syria's Children Die Choking, the West Tut-Tuts Briefly and Moves On. This is now normal. Now, right, within 24 hours of a Tuesday morning chemical weapons attack that left the corpses of several dozen innocents strewn across the streets of Khan Shikun, a bomb-cratered town in the Syrian province of Idlib, everything went back to normal again. The single most horrific poison gas atrocity since the Syrian regime of Bashar al-Assad was allowed to get away with murdering more than 1,000 civilians in the Damascus suburb in August 2013. It took less than a day to show that nothing of consequence had changed. So he let Assad get away with it then, he gets away with it now. Or at least so far, we'll get to that in just a couple of minutes, but he certainly thought he could get away with it. The NATO presidents and prime ministers perform their ritual expressions of revulsion and outrage and shock. Britain, France and the United States brought yet another resolution to an emergency meeting of the United Nations Security Council, which was meeting on Wednesday anyway, so no bother. The resolution contained language intended to be just useless enough to avoid the embarrassment of Russia and China employing their double veto for a seventh time to prevent the Security Council from adopting any effective measure to bring an end to the plodding and now barely newsworthy Syrian genocide. Even so, Russia said the resolution was anti-Syrian and based on fake information, and China said the resolution was distorting matters. It has not mattered that the barbarism of chemical weapons has been subject to international censure since 1899, or that the deployment of poison gas in warfare has been a foundational taboo of international law since 1925, or that the Ghouta sarin gas massacre was the most savage of its kind in the 21st century, or that the UN's first and foremost purpose is to prevent this kind of evil taking place. So we can see very clearly that Mr. Obama's approach of retreating from that red line, trusting the Russians to deal with this situation, has utterly, utterly failed. And even though we have articles like this lamenting how little the US has done over the years, there are some signs that things could be changing. there are some signs of even quite a sharp change in U.S. posture. Some have been already very strongly criticizing Mr. Trump's administration because of earlier comments indicating that he wouldn't stop Assad doing this kind of thing. And perhaps those comments did make Assad kind of embolden him and think that he could get away with this. But his attitude looks like it could be changing. The attitude of his whole administration could be changing. At that UN Security Council meeting yesterday, U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley, I like so many of her speeches to the United Nations, but she gave a really outstanding speech to the Security Council. It's about 7 minutes long, so I won't play the whole thing. And instead, I've picked out about 3 minutes of highlights. But to be honest, it was hard even choosing highlights. I felt like I still left quite a few good, powerful sound bites out. So if you feel inclined, if you're interested in this, go and look up that full 7 minute video or look up the transcript. But here's what she said about those attacks in the UN Security Council yesterday.
Yesterday morning, we awoke to pictures, to children, foaming at the mouth, suffering convulsions, being carried in the arms of desperate parents. We saw rows of lifeless bodies, some still in diapers, some with visible scars of a chemical weapons attack. Look at those pictures. We cannot close our eyes to those pictures. We cannot close our minds of the responsibility to act. Evidence reported from the scene indicates that Assad is now using even more lethal chemical agents than he did before. The gas that fell out of the sky yesterday was more deadly, leaving men, women, the elderly, and children gasping for their very last breath. And as first responders, doctors, and nurses rushed to help the victims, a second round of bombs rained down. They died in the same slow, horrendous manner as the civilians they were trying to save. We all also know this. Just a few weeks ago, this council attempted to hold Assad accountable for suffocating his own people to death with toxic chemicals. Russia stood in the way of this accountability. They made an unconscionable choice. They chose to close their eyes to the barbarity. They defied the conscience of the world. Russia cannot escape responsibility for this. In fact, if Russia had been fulfilling its responsibility, there would not even be any chemical weapons left for the Syrian regime to use. There is one more thing we know. We know that if nothing is done, these attacks will continue. If we are not prepared to act, then this council will keep meeting month after month to express outrage at the continuing use of chemical weapons, and it will not end. We will see more conflict in Syria. We will see more pictures that we can never unsee. I began my remarks by saying that in the life of the United Nations, there are times when we are compelled to take collective action. I will now add this. When the United Nations consistently fails in its duty to act collectively, there are times in the life of states that we are compelled to take our own action. For the sake of the victims, I hope the rest of the council is finally willing to do the same. The world needs to see the use of chemical weapons and the fact that they will not be tolerated. Thank you.
That was Nikki Haley, bits from Nikki Haley's powerful speech at the United Nations yesterday. And she brought with her some of those pictures. She was holding them up as she spoke there. But notice how she was concluding that speech. That we have that if the United Nations won't act, well, we have the obligation at times to act alone. to act outside the United Nations, and we hope the United Nations will act, but we're willing to act now. It's starting to look like this attack could be a major turning point for Syria, that America is talking about action, that the old approach has proven utterly, utterly ineffective. So could the US, could Europe, could others be about to try something new? Well, here's what US President Donald Trump said yesterday about the attack. And again, another few clips kind of pieced together from some of his comments.
Yesterday, chemical attack. A chemical attack that was so horrific in Syria against innocent people, including women, small children, and even beautiful little babies, their deaths was an affront to humanity. These heinous actions by the Assad regime cannot be tolerated. The United States stands with our allies across the globe to condemn this horrific attack and all other horrific attacks for that matter. When you kill innocent children, innocent babies, little babies, with a chemical gas that is so lethal, people were shocked to hear what gas it was. That crosses many, many lines, beyond the red line, many, many lines. And I will tell you, that attack on children yesterday had a big impact on me. Big impact. That was a horrible, horrible thing. And I've been watching it and seeing it, and it doesn't get any worse than that. And I have that flexibility, and it's very, very possible. And I will tell you, it's already happened, that my attitude toward Syria and Assad has changed very much.
So that was Donald Trump there at that press conference yesterday. And no, he was very clear, very direct there that, you know, I've changed my thinking on this. Maybe I did say some things before that indicated I supported keeping Assad in power. But, you know, he crossed many, many red lines, more than red lines. And this has changed my thinking on what's going to happen here. The Telegraph, they wrote that the Trump administration had said only last week, that U.S. diplomatic policy on Syria was no longer focused on making Assad leave power. However, Tuesday's attack, the worst chemical attack in Syria for more than 4 years, has dramatically changed Mr. Trump's position. Now, he refrained from saying exactly what he was going to do, but he has said that his policy is different. His policy has changed. And of course, that's of great interest for us here at The Trumpet. And we've been saying for years that there's going to be some big changes in Syria. Here's how Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry introduced a Key of David on this subject back in 2012.
Greetings, everyone. A major prophecy is being fulfilled in Syria, and it's going to change the course of mighty nations on this earth and shake the foundation of this world as never before. And that's going to include America and Britain as well. There is a mysterious prophecy in Psalm 83 that prophesies there's going to be a dramatic and even a violent shift in many nations in this end time that's going to lead right into an all-out war in this world. And it's going to include just about all nations. But you can see it now as you never could see it before. And it's really all about a revolution that's going on in the nation of Syria. And really the power behind most of what I'm talking to you about today is in Germany. Just as we have been prophesying for some 70 years. But this Psalm 83 indicates that Syria is going to have a break with Iran, that they're going to break away. Now, you don't see much of that in the headlines today, but you do see enough violence there to see where it might be able to do that. But most people don't draw that conclusion. We do because we've been prophesying it for, well, close to 20 years now. Well, even before that, actually, I'd say more like 40 or 50 years when you go back into the life of Mr. Armstrong, who taught this even when he was doing a work many years ago.
So a very strong forecast there that there's this prophecy in the Bible in Psalm chapter 83 that Syria is not going to be allied with Iran. And we've been saying that, as Mr. Fleury said, for 20 years and even beyond. And we've been saying that right from the start of the civil war within Syria. And it's a bold prediction, because right now Syria is very strongly allied with Iran. Iran does have a strong presence there, and it's against Europe, it's against Germany. And Mr. Fleury said that, well, that's going to change based on this Bible prophecy. It's going to be allied with Europe. And I don't know of anybody else who's making that forecast. But it is in your Bible. It is something to watch for. And this change in American policy that Mr. Trump was hinting at, more than hinting at, declaring, that could lead to exactly this. It could lead to America getting more involved. It could lead to Europe getting more involved. After all, the migrant crisis gives Europe good reason to be involved. There are already European jet fighters flying over the skies in Syria. Pressure from the U.S. could cause Russia to change its stance on Assad and on his Iranian backers. So this gas attack in Syria clearly demonstrates the failure of U.S. policy in this region. And it could lead to that change in U.S. policy that could lead to the fulfillment of this prophecy that we've been talking about for a long time. Now, Brent Nachtigall has put together an article on this for our website. If you want to look at this in more detail, it's being proofread as we speak. We'll try and get that up for you shortly after this program. It's called AP Syrian Gas Attack is Enormous Political Gamble. And he goes over some of this in this article. He writes, while Bible prophecy isn't so specific as to indicate whether the U.S. will now act to remove the Assad regime, we have forecast since the beginning of the Civil War that there was going to be a drastic change to the power politics in Syria, especially related to Iran's influence. Until this chemical attack on Tuesday, many commentators believed that the Syrian civil war was winding down, with Assad, Iran's proxy leader in Damascus, retaining power. However, now Assad's position in power is looking tenuous once again. What's for the United States government to assemble a possible coalition of the willing in order to further isolate the Assad regime in Syria? So far, Russia has stayed in lockstep with supporting Assad, but this could change with the right leverage and concessions. Also, look for Europe to potentially become more vocal and affirming of Trump's stance on Syria. So a clear demonstration of where America's foreign policy has failed, and a very interesting avenue that we could see Bible prophecy fulfilled in this region for what we've been saying about Syria very soon. We'll take a quick break, and when we get back, we'll talk about another major news event or topic for conversation of the day.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Herbert W. Armstrong long forecast the arrival of a military superpower in Europe. In a world where European nations can't rely on the United States, one in which they fear Russia and face the constant threat of radical terror, their only hope of survival is to band together. This is what we see happening, and what we see happening was prophesied in your Bible. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire to learn about the history of Germany and the Holy Roman Empire and to understand where the events in Europe today are leading. 3,000 years ago, the prophet Daniel explained that at the time of the end, radical Islam would push against Europe. That time is now. We are witnessing the first manifestations of this Islamist push against Europe, and it's leading to a spectacular clash between these two prophesied kings, the King of the North and the King of the South. What does the Bible say about the identity of these two kings? What about the end time? Will everyone be affected by these events? Request our two booklets, The King of the South
and Germany and the Holy Roman Empire. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
President Trump today signing two executive orders aimed at reducing the U.S. trade deficit. The orders come one week before he meets with the Chinese president in Mar-a-Lago, which he, of course, calls the Southern White House. Trump already tweeting, though, about the meeting, saying that it will be a very difficult one. Let's get some perspective. Former U.S. Ambassador to China and former Democratic Senator from Montana, Max Baucus, is joining me right now. Mr. Ambassador, thanks so much for the time.
You bet, Kate. Absolutely.
So the president says, he tweets it out. He says this meeting next week will be a very difficult one. Why do you think that is? Do you agree?
I think it could be difficult. We Americans have opened up our borders more than have other countries, especially China. China is quite closed. And really, this comes down to a test of will, test of strength. The Chinese understand strength, I think, better than do people any place else in the world. And they can smell weakness farther away than anybody. So the United States has to be strong, but in a measured, solid, considered way. President Trump at Mar-a-Lago has to tell President Xi in China, hey, you're just too protectionist. We're not allowed to take send our products into China. Your investment climate is just too close. You got to change that. And Trump has to be willing to not only say that to President Xi, but to back it up with certain actions that we're going to have to take if China does not open up.
Next week, big week. What can we expect from his meeting with the Chinese president? He already tweeted that that meeting will be very difficult.
Well, I think this is a really, really important meeting for several reasons. One is we're coming on the heels of the Angela Merkel handshake gate meeting, so people are going to be really looking at what the tone of the president takes, especially after he's signing these tough executive orders against China.
So a very important meeting that's taking place today. Chinese President Xi Jinping is coming to the U.S. He'll be meeting with Mr. Trump in Mar-a-Lago, as you heard, and that was a compilation of reports from CNN and Fox Business. As we just heard then, Mr. Trump said it's going to be a tough meeting. They're going to talk about trade. They're going to talk about dealing with North Korea. So what can we expect from this meeting today and tomorrow? Well, what kind of things can we expect from U.S.-China relations? Obviously, I don't know exactly how the meeting will go, but there have been a lot of significant events out of China recently that tells us a lot about the country's priority, that gives us a lot of good background about where U.S.-China relations are heading. We we've got a few articles coming up on our website on China. We've had a few go up. One article that should be up on our website within a few hours, probably at some point by the end of the day, is titled "China is Nearly Finished Militarizing Spratly Islands." And it's based on a report from the Asia Maritime Transparency Initiative. They published a report on March 27 that said that China was now just putting the finishing touches on its islands there, its island bases in that region. Something you've heard a lot about? Well, they're nearly done. This article says in 2013, China began dredging three sites in the Spratlys to construct islands capable of holding airfields. Along with the airfields, the bases have already had structures for mobile missile launches and surface-to-air structures installed, hangars capable of holding dozens of combat craft are nearly completed. China can now deploy military assets, including combat aircraft and missiles, to the Spratly Islands at any time. So any time. They're pretty much there. They're nearly very close to being finished. They're just about operational now. And this Asia Maritime Transparency Initiative, they write that China's three air bases in the Spratlys and another on Woody Island in the Paracels will allow Chinese military aircraft to operate over nearly the entire South China Sea. This Trumpet article goes on to state that each year, $5.3 trillion of trade passes through the South China Sea, one third of the world's maritime commerce. The U.S. has protected this vital trade route, but as America retreats from its traditional role, China has been filling the vacuum. China not only wants to control the trade route, it also wants a security buffer so it can operate without having to worry about U.S. military forces. China's progress in the Spratlys is fulfilling that objective perfectly. So we've been talking about what China's been doing, the built military buildup in this region for quite some time. And now these islands, they're nearly finished. They're nearly operational. They're just about operational already. And America has just let that happen. You know, maybe, I guess that America could still confront them over that, but really getting somebody off a finished base is much, much harder than just stopping someone from building a base. It's reached a new phase now. It'd be much harder for America to do anything about it. China has that power now on these contested islands. And we'll talk a bit more about what we've said on that in the past in a minute. But here's another article. Again, another one that should be up on our website. This one, I think, is scheduled to go up in another 7-8 hours or so, called China Steps Up Shipbuilding Again. And this article states, merely a decade ago, the United States Navy was considered the world's largest and most advanced fleet, capable of projecting its power across the globe, while China's small fleet, on the other hand, didn't even include frigates. Only capable of producing coastal fast attack fleet at a reasonable rate, it maintained only a regional influence. But in the years since, China has produced destroyer and frigate programs, meaning it can aim to challenge the US in the region. China is boosting its production of warships as well as extending its reach around the world. And the National Interest on April 2nd carried an article by Lyle Goldstein, and it said, not only are China's simultaneous destroyer and frigate and cruiser and cutter programs the envy of the world, Beijing's aspiration to wield supercarriers is no longer a laughing matter at all. Goldstein also writes that they're completing perhaps the world's largest nuclear submarine fabrication facility. There's a Chinese strategic emerging industry website. It was talking about a new super factory that China claimed that they've set up. And this website, it's a Chinese government, or at least, well, everything over there is pretty much owned by the Chinese government. It's a communist country. But it says that Western production lines, for the most part, can only build one submarine, and only the US is capable of building two submarines simultaneously. But China is now capable of building four. The facility is projected, our article goes on to write, that the facility is projected to double the rate of nuclear submarine productions over the course of the next 2 to 3 years. Then also from this same National Interest article, it brought out that the Chinese naval magazine Naval and Merchant Ships carried an article titled, China Might Send Submarines to Guard the Port of Gwadar. And this is a Pakistani port that China has long, or for quite a few years, had a strong presence in with the cooperation of Pakistan. And this, going back to this Trumpet article, it says these submarines would work together with the Pakistan Navy to protect the port and also maritime trade routes. The report also says there is the possibility that the Chinese Navy will build a base there and use it to, quote, support the activities of its fleet in the Indian Ocean. And Goldstein writes, true, the source of this information is revealed to be the Pakistan Navy, but it would be quite unusual for this Navy-affiliated magazine to lead with such a headline if there were no basis to it. And Goldstein writes that these and other developments should raise some eyebrows in Washington, New Delhi, and elsewhere. And then The Diplomat, they carried an article recently where they interviewed Dr. Sam Beatston. He's a teaching fellow at the Lao China Institute at King's College London. And he wrote that China is expanding as a maritime power in terms of port and shipping assets, naval power and independence, not unlike the UK 200 years ago. And remember, 200 years ago, that was when the UK was really the new rising superpower. Not unlike the UK 200 years ago, and it's exporting to other areas of empire. China has in a tenticular fashion, I kind of like that word, tenticular fashion. Seems a bit of a fancy way of saying has its tentacles everywhere, but there's a certain ring to it. Tenticular fashion invested billions of dollars in expanding its international port network, in addition to Chinese naval hardware, including surface vessels such as warships and aircraft carriers, and nuclear submarines such as those stationed on the Hainan Island province's southern coast. So China is rapidly growing as a maritime power. It's growing these bases. And here's what Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry said about this back in 2015, as China was building those bases in some of these artificial islands.
If you look, for example, at China today, there's a lot of tension now between China and the U.S., and China is going out and making a series of man-made islands 800 miles from their shore, and the South China Sea. And of course, that land belongs to others as well as to them. They're out in international waters, but they are just building military bases there. And one third of the world's commerce flows right through that area, that South China Sea. One third of the world's commerce, and the U.S. has dominated that area since World War II. And now China's challenging them openly before the world, saying, we're going to dominate this area from now on. And nobody's stopping them. Nobody's even really talking about it that much, as if, well, it didn't really exist. But look, that isn't their territory. They're pushing their neighbors around and taking parts of their territory. And where is this going to lead? They have all this power. Now they've decided they're going to shift from defense to offense. Before, they've been concerned about controlling their billion people to make sure they keep their government intact. Now they've got that under control, well under control, and they're going to go on the offense. And let me tell you, this should frighten the world.
It certainly should. And as you said, America wasn't stopping them. America didn't stop them. And now those bases are almost complete. And the diplomat, actually, in that article that I quoted, made almost the same point about how easy it is to shift from defense to offense with that Navy capability. It writes that a naval vessel keeping sea lanes open for trade can very easily be used to keep them shut at the signaling voice of one hierarchical command. And is in this sense, a Chinese naval vessel today keeping sea lanes open could thwart innocent flight of passage practically overnight. And now it's got those bases nearly complete as well. And that's another sign of America's weakness. It was something America didn't deal with, and now it's almost too late, or certainly much harder to deal with. Safari made similar comments to the ones that we heard in an article over the summer called China is Steering the World Towards War. And he talked about how China is claiming the entire South China Sea as its own by building artificial islands atop coral reefs in the Spratlys and installing surface-to-air missile batteries in the Paracels. China is building a new strategic sea gate, he writes. After passing through the Strait of Malacca, oil tankers and other ships passing between Spratly and the Paracel Islands on their way through to the South China Sea. Whoever controls these vital sea gates controls one-third of the world's maritime commerce. And if this is something you're unfamiliar with, go back and look for that article. China is Steering the World Towards War. We'll post a link to it underneath one of these newer articles up on our website. I'm sure you're familiar, if you've been there, of how we can read more on those Read More tabs up on the front page to see these more detailed reports giving some background knowledge. And it's a powerful article, and it's full of maps that make it really clear exactly what is happening here, what China is doing, which sea lanes they're pushing into. And at the same time that China is really pushing forward militarily, they're also pushing economically. Kieran Underwood just finished another article yesterday afternoon that we'll have up soon called Russia and China are Finding Ways to Avoid the US Dollar. And he begins this article by writing, it's becoming easier to imagine the coming post-US financial order. He writes, ever since the Bretton Woods Conference in 1944, when the world's major power settled on a new standardized monetary system, America has dominated world finance. When the system fell apart in 1971 and countries switched to floating exchange rates, the US dollar remained the reserve currency. But in a post-global financial crisis world, Russia and China are finding new ways to avoid using the dollar. And they've just over the last month, there have been some big announcements along this. So March 14th, the Central Bank of Russia opened its first overseas office. And its very first overseas office was in Beijing. Then on March 29th, the Industrial and Commercial Bank of China, it established a clearing bank in Moscow to handle transactions in the Chinese currency, in the renminbi, making it easier for them to directly trade in their own currencies without relying on the dollar. And then Russia is preparing to issue bonds in Chinese currency. The Financial Times wrote, Russia's finance ministry is to issue $1 billion worth of renminbi in 1 or 2 months' time, ideally. And Kieran, in this article, talks about how Russia has been cut off from a lot of Western economies due to sanctions over Ukraine and things like that. So now it's drawing close to China instead. And then he goes on to talk about how China is really making an effort to reach out for economies around the world. And again, he quotes, there's an article from the Financial Times that he quotes that was published on April 5th. And they write, a retreat from globalization ultimately means, at least partly, a retreat from the dollar and from the U.S.-centric global financial system. Then this article says, there is no more dramatic illustration of the extent to which the U.S. has turned its back on the world than to look at the swap lines the Federal Reserve maintains with its overseas counterparts to make dollars available in cases of stress. The Fed maintains just 5 such lines with Japan, the Eurozone, the UK, Switzerland and Canada, according to Eswar Prasad of Cornell University. And then this article says, even as the US steps back, China is taking a greater role on the global financial stage, despite slowing its timetable for dismantling capital controls. In contrast to the 5 swap lines from the Fed, the People's Bank of China maintains 37. So the US just has these 5 lines to make dollars available. China's put together 37 lines to make dollars available, renminbi available. It's trying to really be the friend of these emerging economies, to draw them over to the Chinese financial system, to the Chinese currency instead of the dollar. Now another, the diplomat article I quoted from also talks about the economic as well as the military advances China is making. It talks about how China's spending around $50 billion US dollars on 40 port projects around the world. And it writes that Chinese container shipping lines taken together dwarf other countries' container flows. And even ports like Miami and Houston are 49% owned by China. So we see China's working to secure its own backyard and it's working to build this global trade empire. And we can see trade war building, something we've talked about a lot on this show. Trade wars that were the subject of the front cover of our most recent Trumpet magazine. And that cover article by Brad McDonald, Trumpet contributing editor, it talks about this scripture in Isaiah 23, which prophesies of a mart of nations, a trading block of nations. And he writes, in this prophecy, the end time Tyre is shown to be in a trade relationship with China and other Asian peoples. The mention of the sea, oceans, ships, and seaborne merchant traffic indicate this is a trade alliance. So you see the sea being highlighted there, and you see China building its trade links across the sea. Mart means emporium, trade, or merchandise, he writes. Verse 13 mentions Italy, Chaldea. Italy here is depicted in association with Germany, whose biblical identity is Assyria or Asher. Clearly, this is a prophecy about an end-time trade axis between Europe and Asia. Notice, too, Mr. McDonald continues, America and Britain are not part of this mart of nations. Why not? Because this trade emporium is a rival of the US and Britain. It is infused with strong anti-American and anti-British sentiments. This mart of nations exists to compete with America and Britain. And then he quotes Mr. Flurry in his booklet Isaiah's End Time Vision, where he writes, we believe that there will be a brief alliance, or that there may be a brief alliance between the German-led Holy Roman Empire and certain Asian powers. And it talks about how this German-led trade conglomerate will be a dynamic market of nations. He also warns that this mart of nations is, quote, going to besiege America, Britain, and the Jewish nation. And we can see, you can see that over in Ezekiel 5. So that's the background to the relations between America and China. That's where relations are going. It doesn't necessarily tell us exactly what to expect in today's meeting, but as I said, it does tell us where this is going. China's been aggressively expanding its naval presence. America's not stood up to them. Now, America's stance, it may become a bit harder under Mr. Trump, but we still see where this is leading. China's building this global trade and maritime alliance. Europe is, as we've talked about before, looking more and more to China. And they're going to be a major partner, a leading partner with China in that. So you see this conflict building, and it'll be interesting to see how this is reflected in this very challenging meeting with Mr. Trump that will be taking place over today and tomorrow. Well, that's about it from me. If you want to look into anything that we've discussed today, take a look at our website, thetrumpet.com. We have links to, we have our newer articles posted there. We have links to these older articles that we've discussed. Brent's article on Syria that I mentioned, it has some of the same sound bites and video footage that we've used. You can download all of our literature from there as well. Mr. Stephen Flowey, I believe your regular host, will be back tomorrow. So tune in then and keep listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show here on KPCG 101.3 FM.